You'll notice that I put up there the Text Me Bro phone numbers. If you have a question about the series or about any of the stuff that I say today, I'd just invite you to take down one of those numbers and send us a text regarding that. We won't answer it today, but we are collecting some of those questions, and we'll be addressing most of them in the next couple of weeks. So send in your questions, and we will deal with them. We've been talking about God's story, and I hope by now you're beginning to see that nothing in the events of history or the scriptures or even your life, for that matter, are random. All of these events are purposeful and they're deliberate and they're moving methodically toward a specific objective. And we've also seen how God's story not only helps us understand that things aren't random, they are intentional, but it also helps us to answer some of the questions of life that we wrestle with, such as, who are we? And we've seen that we are unique, created beings invested with a special dignity and a special value because we are created in the image and likeness of God. And that sets us apart from everything else that there is. And part of that uniqueness, part of that image, is that the ability to make moral choices that have real consequences. And even though we were created to know and to fellowship with our Creator, we were given the ability to choose not to. That's pretty amazing. God's creation, we saw, was ultimately and thoroughly good at the very beginning. But when we look around, we see that it's not so good. There's a lot of problems in the world. So we ask the question, well, what went wrong? When mankind, the scriptures help us see, represented in Adam, chose independence from God, all creation, including all subsequent generations of mankind were affected. And we saw there that death entered God's creation, and life, as it was designed to be experienced by God, began to unravel. And we saw very early on that the first recorded loss of life occurs as God takes the life of an innocent animal to provide adequate coverings for the man and the woman's nakedness. And we saw relationships begin to break down as man hides from God even. And the man and the woman feel shame at being exposed to one another. And they begin to blame one another and everything else that moves for their own wrong behavior. And it didn't take very long for us to see that humanity begins to treat one another inhumanely. As we see, saw Cain kills his brother Abel. Violence filled the earth at the time of the flood and shortly after. And instead of honoring their creator, mankind begins to honor themselves right after the flood. And all of this seems to happen in rapid fire succession, at least as the story is related to us. So we ask, what is the solution? How do we fix this? What are we going to do about this? What's the answer? Well, God promises that there is an answer, and He will provide it through a descendant that will come from the woman who will crush the serpent's head and eventually set all things right. Now, so far in the story, we've seen that God has made two covenants or two promises or two contracts with mankind. And these are promises of coming redemption and restoration of the planet. The first one of those promises is the promise of a Redeemer in Genesis 3:15. And this is such a key verse. I mean, a lot of stuff throughout the Bible and a lot of the answers to our questions are wrapped up in this verse where God speaking says, I will put enmity, I will put hostility between you, the serpent or the devil, and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head, and you will crush his heel. In other words, there's going to be this continual struggle, this war going on between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, but eventually a solution will come. And that seed, that heir, that descendant of the woman's will put an end to this once and for all. And although it's not directly stated in contractual terms, the promise in Genesis 3:15 is a promise made by God that the seed of the woman will eventually set all things right. And even though it's not contractually stated, it is still binding and will be effective. The seed would be the solution to the mess that Adam made when he ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. There are no other solutions apart from him. And then we saw a week or so ago the second covenant, and it's called the Noahic covenant. We saw it in Genesis 9, verses 9 through 11, where God speaking again says, I now establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you and with every living creature that was with you, the birds, the livestock, and all the wild animals, all those that came out of the ark with you, every living creature on earth. I establish my covenant with you. Here it is. Never again will all life be cut off by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. Now, remember, this comes on the heels of God taking some very harsh steps to cleanse the earth of the immorality and the violence that has engulfed it. And this is really very significant because the promise of Genesis 3:15 came very, very close to not happening. And in fact, the human race came very, very close to ceasing to be. But God, by the narrowest of margins, rescues the human race, and in doing that, rescues the line of the woman from which the seed will come by telling Noah to build an ark in which he and his family would ride above God's judgment. It was a close call. And that brings us now, this week, to one of the most important characters in the Bible. And that is the man Abraham. God's dealing with Abraham begins in Genesis chapter 12. He's mentioned very briefly, just in a short thumbnail sketch of his lineage. But God's dealing with Abraham in chapter 12 is a pivotal point in human history and in the scriptures. Because God there begins to narrow the possibilities from which the seed of the woman will come. And so in this chapter, God makes a third covenant. It's called the Abrahamic covenant. And this is really important because it is a guarantee that the promises of Genesis 3:15 will happen. It is a lockdown guarantee. And we read it first appears in Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3. The Lord had said to Abram, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all the peoples on the earth will be blessed through you. Very interesting interaction between Abraham and God begins with those words. And I just want for us today to pull out three of the key lessons that we learn in Abraham's life and in this interaction. The first is, for want of a better description, is that we now see history and the scriptures actually beginning to funnel down and become more and more specific and more narrow, more and more narrowly defined. God's story now is progressing from the general to the specific, and it's fine-tuning his story. And he starts out with all of humanity, Abraham and Noah and Shem, or Seth, is the route that the line of the woman will travel. But then he narrows that down a little bit more from all humanity to Semitic peoples in the person of Shem. Now, that's still a pretty big group of people, but he narrows it even further here in chapter 12 to the nation Israel, and that is the descendants of Abraham. And this is really pivotal because you'll start reading about him over and over and over throughout the Old Testament and throughout the New Testament even, is constantly being mentioned of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, repeating that that flow of history and really the line of this descendant that's going to come and solve the problems. But it gets focused even tighter, more narrowly, in that it focuses down from just the descendants of Abraham to now this seed will come from a tribe of Judah. Judah is one of the descendants of Jacob. And remember, he had 12 sons, so it's getting more and more fine-tuned. And it actually gets down even to the single family, the family of David. And through David and then through Mary, we get the seed that finally appears on the planet Earth, and that is Jesus. Now, Matthew, you can see this progression if you take the time to really wrestle with the genealogies that you find, especially in Genesis, but other parts of the scriptures. But it's a little clearer, more of a thumbnail sketch, if you look in the Old Testament or New Testament in Matthew and Luke's genealogies of Jesus. It's more of a thumbnail sketch of this progression from all humanity down through to come to the seed himself of Jesus. And I put the references there of those two genealogies on the screen if you would like to check them out later. Genesis, now it's really important to understand how Genesis is structured, because a lot of times we kind of get confused. We think of things chronologically, and really Genesis has a very regular pattern of treating things that are less important to the main theme very briefly, and then coming back and expanding or giving additional detail on the things that are of greater importance to the main theme. It's already done this several times between chapter 1 and chapter 12, but a real good example of this is there's only two chapters in Genesis record the story of creation. Only a single chapter, one chapter, records mankind's fall from innocence into sin, but the story of Abraham covers 13 chapters as well as parts of two other chapters. I mean, a big, significant a block of time and information are given to us about him. And the reason for that is he is a key element in the fulfillment of God's promise. And the focus of God's story now begins to really narrow as it progresses toward the fulfillment of that promise in Genesis 3:15. And essentially, the rest of the Bible, although it contains a lot of instructions for living life, the rest of the Bible is essentially the story of the seed of the woman and how he gets here, how this happens. It's God's story as it plays out to the end of the story. And it really, in a lot of different ways, in different places, it covers its development as it progresses. You'll see more about Abraham and then some about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There's more details given to that as this line develops, more details given. It covers a lot of this line of descendants' failures. They weren't spotless by any means. And they're near extinction. Sometimes it comes really close. The book of Esther is a good example of that. Man, it almost gets snuffed out again there. Throughout the Bible, there are plenty of reiterations of God's commitment to redeem and restore creation through the line of Abraham and ultimately this seed promised clear back in Genesis 3:15. It gives us, as the Bible unfolds, it gives us glimpses of the seed's identity so that humanity would be able to recognize him when he got here. We're looking for him throughout the Old Testament, and it gives us some ideas of who he is and his identity so that mankind could recognize him when he got here. And then there's more promises of his eventual conquest of the serpent and the restoration of his rule on earth. And finally, we get to the end of the story, the book of Revelation, the final victory of the seed over the serpent. Man, I'd like to fast forward to that one in history right now. Let's get this over with, wouldn't you? Now, as you read and study the Bible, it's important that you keep that in mind. This isn't just a bunch of random things that we pull out random theologies from. This is going somewhere. This has a theme to it. There is an intentional, deliberate movement to the scriptures as well as to human history. It's not random. And it's important that you keep that in mind as you study the Bible, because that is the context into which everything else, just about everything else, fits in some way or another. So it's really, really important that you get that storyline, God's story, firmly rooted in your mind, and use that as the grid by which you interpret the rest of the scriptures. The second thing, important lesson here, has to do with the Abrahamic covenant himself. And I'm just going to very briefly touch on it today, because it is such a significant thing here, relevant to our conversation. But Noah's going to really dive into it in more detail next week. But the Abrahamic covenant is really an amazing thing. This is where God's covenants with mankind also funnel down from a very wide, broad scope to a single individual now. And it's important to observe some of its characteristics and some of the contrast between it and some of the other things. And you see the significance of this contract between God and Abraham right there in chapter 12, in Genesis 12 through 17. It's reiterated at least five times, sometimes only in part, sometimes in whole. And it gives great detail to it. We'll see here in a minute in chapter 15. Whenever you see the scriptures repeating something like that, you need to understand it's like God waving a big red flag saying, pay attention. This is important. Do not miss this. Now, some of the difference between what's known as the Noahic covenant and the Abrahamic covenant, I think, bears checking out. First of all, the Noahic covenant, the covenant that God made with mankind after Noah came out of the ark, is between God and the entire human race. It's very general, very broad. The Abrahamic covenant is between God and an individual, not the entire nations of the world. The Noahic covenant is God's promise not to do something. In that covenant, he promises, I will never again wipe out the planet with a flood. Okay? He doesn't promise not to wipe it out, though. Okay, I'll just throw that in there for your FYI. But the Abrahamic covenant is God's promise to do something. He is going to provide Abraham with descendants, with land, and with blessings on the earth through him. The earth will be better and blessed because of Abraham in his life. God is going to bless the earth through Abraham. Now, the sign of the Noahic covenant was the rainbow. I love the rainbow. They're awesome. The sign of the Abrahamic covenant was circumcision. Now, I've always been glad that I have never personally had to face that decision to obey or disobey that particular command. I'm glad that was up to Abraham. But it's really interesting why God chooses that particular way of memorializing this covenant. It's never really made a whole lot of sense to me until we put it in the context. And I was reading Victor Hamilton, Handbook on the Pentateuch. And he had a great discussion about an explanation of circumcision. And he makes sense of it here. Let me read it to you. This mark, circumcision, indelibly cut into the flesh, now becomes a witness, a sign, to identify with God and God's people. The connection of circumcision with the covenant is made clear by the emphasis on the body part that is involved. If circumcision's significance was merely the cutting or making of some part of the human body, then something such as cutting one's hair or piercing one's nose or ear or even branding a mark on one's hand or forehead would have sufficed. Now get this. Circumcision, however, requires the cutting of the part of the body through which God's promise will be revealed or will be fulfilled. It's very specific, very detailed, and very meaningful. It is the sign that the descendant of the woman will be coming down through Abraham, who at that time was childless. And it identifies, it is a physical, visible mark identifying all of his male descendants as part of that line. And it serves as a constant reminder until we just ritualize it and forget the significance behind it. But it served as a constant reminder that the seed of the woman is coming, and it's coming through Abraham, and these are his people. This is the people through whom he will come. Well, you know, this really brings me to another question, and that is, why is there so much trouble in the Middle East? I mean, there always has been, it seems like. Why won't this small, insignificant piece of dirt just go away? Why is it still such a big deal in world events? I think the answer to that question is found in the details of the covenant. First off, God promises that there will be offspring from Abraham. He says in chapter 12, verse 2, you will be the father of a great nation. Now, you read the Old Testament and even today's headlines, and one of the factors motivating the world against Israel is that it exists. To make these people mad and upset, is all you got to do is continue to exist as a nation. And so you see the Egyptians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Nazis, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Hezbollah, the PLO, and on and on and on, the list could go. All have had one thing in mind, and that for Israel, and that is its extinction. That's the only thing that will make them happy with respect to Israel. Now, think about this. Who do you think is behind such irrational hatred for one race of people? What do you think is motivating this? Well, go back to Genesis 3:15. I will put hostility between you and the woman, and between your offspring. See, there's a counterfeit line going on here too, a counterfeit kingdom. It's Satan's. And there's going to be hostility between his offspring and the woman's offspring. And eventually that offspring is going to crush the serpent's head, even though he's going to be wounded pretty seriously himself. And Satan has been working overtime ever since the Garden of Eden in Genesis 3:15 in a desperate attempt to stop this promise from coming true. He is highly motivated. Even after the seed is born, King Herod, in Matthew 1:16, sends soldiers to kill all the boys in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old and under. He missed him, he got born, and he's going to kill all of them to try to get rid of it. Now, Herod didn't know, oh, the seed of the woman happened. No, Herod's just the tool that Satan is using to try to obliterate this line and stop this promise from coming true. There's been this concerted effort throughout history to either annihilate this group of people, the line of Abraham, or water them down and blur them so much that they no longer exist. So God promises you're going to be a great nation. There will be offspring. He also promises blessing to the nations through him. In verse 3, he says, all the families on the earth will be blessed through you. You see, here's the deal. The blessing to the nations is the seed of the woman who comes and crushes the serpent's head and with him brings redemption and restoration to God's creation, including the nations of the world. Most of us here are Gentiles. We know God. We have fellowship with God. We look forward to being with him someday because the seed came through Abraham and we are blessed through him. And then he promises them a land. Verse 7, I am going to give all this land to you and your offspring. And this is not, temporary. In chapter 13, verse 15, he says this is a permanent possession. Now, the covenant is again reiterated and actually made official in chapter 15. Noah's going to talk about that more next week. I just want to say a couple of things about it. In that day, one of the common practices, they didn't sign contracts so much. They made an agreement, and then they would cut specific animals in half and spread them out so there's a little walkway in between the parts. And then both parties would walk down through that mess, through those carcasses, And the significance of it was, is that they were saying, if I fail to uphold my end of this bargain, then may what happened to these animals happen to me. Well, God does that. He tells Abraham, split these things open, and then knocks Abraham out, and God walks through it by himself. Now, here's the interesting thing. In walking between the animal carcasses, God places himself under a potential curse. And it's a figurative way of God saying, if I fail to live up to this contract, may what was done to these animals be done to me. God places himself under a potential curse. Now, I mentioned this to my wife this week, and she asked me, well, how can God curse himself? You know what? I think that is exactly the point. It ain't going to happen. And that's the point he's making. Heaven and earth will pass away before this promise goes unfulfilled, period. Now, if you were a world leader, how would you like to step in front of that bulldozer? Where God says, I will be torn apart like these animals before this promise fails to happen. Whoa, I don't want to get in the way of that. Now, Israel is far from perfect, but I'd be very careful about contributing to their downfall. God says, I will bless those who bless you. I will curse those who curse you. World, you're on notice. That's why Israel and the Middle East remains a hot issue to this day, and it won't go away. And it's not going to go away until finally the seed comes down in victory and it completely solves the problem and does a new heaven and new earth. The third lesson here is really huge. The New Testament, the Apostle Paul especially, keeps coming back to it repeatedly, and that is the idea of justification by faith. In chapter 15, verse 6, it is stated that Abraham believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. This is the first mention of justification in the Bible. It's the first look at the real solution to the problem that Adam created. The flood cleansed the earth, but it didn't get to the heart of the problem, which is we need a new heart. We need redemption and restoration. That was only a temporary cleansing. And although at this stage of the story, it's still in skeletal form, the fulfillment of the covenant made by God with Abraham will be the means that God uses to provide full redemption and ultimate restoration and reconciliation between God and his creation, including us. Now, many of the events of Abraham's life, even, that are recorded in Genesis 12 through 24, actually illustrate how God plans to redeem us from the mess that Adam made and restore creation to its intended condition. I'll give you three examples. You can write down these references and check them out later. Genesis 18, verses 16 through 33, it's really interesting, the account of Sodom and Gomorrah. And righteous Abraham there in that part of the story intercedes for wicked Sodom and Gomorrah, just like Jesus intercedes for us when we blow it. In Genesis 21, 1 through 8, the promised son is conceived via a miraculous conception, if you will. And in Luke 1, 26 through 38, Jesus is born of a virgin. A lot of parallels there. This one is really a mind blower because in Genesis 22, 1 through 14, Abraham offers his only son, the son of the promise, and God provides a substitute. It reminds me of John 3:16 that tells us that God gave his only begotten son as a substitute for us so that we could be redeemed and reconciled with God. Well, what bearing does all of this have to our lives today? What does what we call salvation, that is being justified with God, what does that look like in everyday life? In our normal paradigm of our circles and our types of churches, It's really about the content of our faith. That's what we really major on. You got to know and believe the right bullet points of theology. But in Genesis, it did include the content of your faith. That was important, but it really had more to do with the direction of your life. It had more to do with the character and the nature of your life in relation to God than just solely the content of your faith. Go back to Genesis 11, verses 1 through 4, and look at some interesting contrasts there. It says, "Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, 'Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly.' They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the earth.'" Did you notice what drove them, what their motive was? Well, first of all, they didn't want to be scattered. They were saying, "Man, we like it here. We like each other." And God had repeatedly said that they were to fill the earth. In other words, spread out and bring the earth in its entirety into full production. And instead, they exercised their ability to make moral choices and decided that they, just like God, could choose to live wherever they wanted. They would do life their way. Reminds me again of Genesis 3:6. The woman saw that the tree was beautiful and its fruit looked delicious, and she wanted the wisdom it would give her, so she took some of the fruit and ate it. It made perfect sense to her. It wasn't really, I wouldn't characterize this act as rebellion as much as independence. I'm doing pretty good on my own. Thank you. What do you think the people who were building the Tower of Babel thought about their work project, what they were doing? Maybe it's a lot like things we hear world leaders saying today. If we just band together, there's nothing we cannot accomplish. Together, we can build something like, the space station, and maybe even inhabit space if we will just come together as a unified body. We live in a global economy, and we need a global currency to solve the economic problems that we are experiencing. If we could just come together as one big global economy. We live in a global community, and maybe we could achieve world peace if we dropped all this nationalism business and formed a world government. Doesn't that make perfect sense? So that's my point. I think it seemed perfectly reasonable and desirable to act independently of God, and essentially they were doing quite well without him anyway. That is really the essence, the core of sin, what the Bible calls sin. Let me ask us a question. Is God the centerpiece of your life? Monday through Saturday. Or have you relegated him to some spiritual compartment of your life? You know, we have other things, family life, work life, important life, business life, and then we have a spiritual life over here that takes up a little bit of time and energy. See, does God make a difference in the totality of your life, or does he just occupy a small part of it? Now, I think the way you answer those questions makes the difference between faith that can justify you before God and a faith that just produces some religious exercises. That seems to be the characteristic difference between Abraham's faith and other people's faith in the Bible, and many of our faith as well. The other thing that was motivating them was that they wanted to make a name for themselves. Now contrast that with the conversation between God and Abraham in Genesis 12, verses 3 and 4, where God says, and you can go through your Bible, I highlighted all the places where it says, "I will," God speaking, "I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing, because I'm going to do it." See, here's the thing. We were created to make a name for God, to honor him as our creator. Making Abraham's name great was God's prerogative and his promise to Abraham. Abraham's job was to obey God. In other words, he was to live under God's authority and within his provision for him. And I would encourage you to read Abraham's life, just the Genesis part of it there. Read his life this week. And if you will, you'll see that Abraham gets into trouble when he loses confidence in God's ability to come through on his promise, and he takes matters in his own hands to fulfill the promise for God. He'll make up for God's inadequacy, if you will. In other words, he acts independently of God. One of the glaring examples of that is Genesis 16. And we end up with Hagar and Ishmael. Remember, Sarah is in her 90s. She hadn't had a child yet. Her biological clock isn't just ticking. The alarm's gone off. And probably wound down by this stage of her life. It's like hopeless. Not only did this, you know, so she says, here, take Hagar. We'll make the baby ourselves. God doesn't seem to be able to handle this. And man, not only did this cause trouble for Abraham, the descendants of Ishmael and Isaac have been fighting to this day. They're still fighting with each other. Victor Hamilton, again, in Handbook on the Pentateuch, made a very interesting observation about Abraham's life. He says, it may be more than incidental that almost all the individuals assembled by the author of Hebrews 11 to illustrate faith have somewhere in their life a fatal flaw, and sometimes more than one. In other words, you even go to the Hall of Fame of faith with God in the Bible, Hebrews chapter 11, and you'll see every one of those people are flawed deeply, sometimes multiple flaws, and they're pretty big ones. But he says, those who adamantly reject God's will for their life, like the people just before the flood and the people building the Tower of Babel, find that their decision is honored. God gives us the ability to make moral decisions that have real consequences, and he will honor that decision, even if it's to have him butt out of our lives. But he says this, those who at least stumble and fall forward in the direction of God's will, like Noah did. Noah was far from perfect, but when he stumbled, he fell toward God, not away from him in independence. Abraham, man, flawed through and through. But when he stumbled, he fell forward toward God's will, not away from God. And he says, these people find divine resource and promise from God. There is forgiveness. There is restoration because they are humble and broken and confess these failures to God. They don't exercise their own independence in a moral decision. Now let me wrap up with this last question. Of these two people, who most closely characterizes you? Nimrod, an independent man, doing quite well on his own. Are you like that? You doing pretty well by yourself, on your own? Or Abraham, who was dependent on God for what really mattered in life? I want you to take a minute and consider these questions. And close your eyes, if you would, and just try to blot everything out. And try to imagine that God is asking these questions of you. And I want you just in the next few quiet minutes to answer him. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. May we be allowed to worship and serve you in peace. May your peace be upon Israel. Amen. Before we leave, don't forget, stop by the Get Connected table and sign up for 101, 201, or 301 if you haven't done that yet. Ushers, would you come and receive the offering from our church family? God bless you. Have a great week.
Accepted.